Hello, I'm Sarah Coakley. I'm a theologian and philosopher of religion, also an Anglican and Episcopal priest, now living in the Washington, D.C. area. And this is the third of a series of theological videos on the topic of what is the good of the church? That is, on the topic that theologians call ecclesiology, the theology of the church. In the first two sessions, we looked initially at visions of kingdom and church in the New Testament, focusing particularly on Jesus's and Paul's teaching. And then in the second session, we looked at key moments in the Western church, focusing especially on the English Reformation because of this particular ecclesial background, and on the 19th century, for the resources for thinking afresh about the nature of the church in our contemporary scenario. In the rest of this series, we're going to be looking at the contemporary scene. And today, I'm going to be in conversation with Scott McDougall, professor of theology, and especially an expert on ecclesiology from the Church Divinity School of the Pacific. He's also, at the moment, co-editor of the Anglican Theological Review. Hello, Scott.
Hello, thank you very much for having me. Good to be with you.
And we're going to start today by thinking about the context in which the Episcopal Church is doing ecclesiology today. Because it seems to me, and I think to you, Scott, as well, that there are some really key and novel challenges for thinking ecclesiologically, and that without confronting these and then looking at the conditions of our contemporary scene for sources of new insight about ecclesiology, it's likely that ecclesiological thinking could be pushed to the background at this period. So the first thing I want to ask you, Scott, because you are an expert on this, you are an ecclesiologist, is it seems to me that perhaps the most obvious challenge for the ecclesiological thinking in the Episcopal Church at the moment is its dramatic loss of membership in North America, in not just today, but indeed cumulatively over recent decades. I wonder whether you could say a word about that and tell us where we are.
Yes, certainly. It is true that the Episcopal Church has lost membership. Over the last decade, we tend to be seeing a 18% loss in membership overall. And on a 10-year scale, we seem to lose about 24 to 30% of our average Sunday attendance over the course of a decade. There are numbers that are indicating what appear to be a downward trend or an exodus of people from the Episcopal Church. Now, this is not unique to Episcopalianism. This is something that is true for Christianity, and indeed, as Robert Putnam has pointed out, for associations of all sorts across the board. So it's a challenge that we're all facing, but be that as it may, it is something that we need to take extremely seriously, and we need to take extremely seriously the complex realities that are driving those changes. One thing that becomes exceedingly salient in doing so, however, is to remember that when we are talking about church, when we are talking about a group of disciples of Christ that gather together for particular reasons in order to worship God and in order to shape the ways in which they will interact in the world, there is a distinction between the way we are that kind of group and the way that other kinds of groups are constituted, having to do with our mission and the vision that drives that mission. And accordingly, while we should be attentive to these numbers, they oughtn't to be the driver of the decisions that we make, in my view. What that tends to do theologically and practically is it tends to result in leadership that comes to a place where it begins to govern out of fear, mm-hmm. and out of a little bit of panic, a bit of appropriate grief and mourning for something that is being lost. There's no question about that. But whether or not this is grounds for despair and therefore for resorting to managerial tactics or importing certain models from the business world that may be less appropriate in this sphere than may appear to be the case at first glance. These are open questions that we need to be very careful about when we're talking about the way church is shaped and the way church is practiced, and above all, the way church is visioned and imagined. What it is.
So really, the danger here might be that we lose our theological confidence at a moment when our theological imaginations need to be reactivated. And one can't help thinking of the Lucan remark that attributed to Jesus, which I'm sure comes from Jesus, Luke 12:32, "Fear not, little flock, your Father is giving you the kingdom." There's also, of course, a complete sea change in the Episcopal Church, or there ought to be, in thinking about ecclesiology, given the extraordinary global aspects of Anglicanism that started, as we saw in the last video, in the 19th century, with the scramble for Africa and beyond. But we can't any longer really think about ecclesiology without thinking globally, right? And what do you think that means for us? The trouble is that when we think globally at the moment, we can only think about the terrible divisions that are occurring within the Anglican Communion and within our own church over questions of gender and sexuality. And these dominate our conceptuality. But how about the theological aspects of turning to a global ecclesiology? What do you think is important here?
I think one of the things that's most critical in turning to a global ecclesiology for the Anglican Communion is to recapture and remember the fact that what church is at its base is a space for practicing how to be in relationship in a new way. This is the kind of reality that Jesus came preaching, calling us to turn toward the kingdom of God as a way of moving ourselves out of one way of regarding reality toward a different one, in which the flourishing of deep relationality, communion in theological terms, becomes the most important thing, meaning the communion between ourselves and God primarily, but then also the communion that we share with one another, the communion with ourselves and our own broken psyches, and the communion between us and the rest of God's creation. So this fourfold communal relationship is the church is the place where we turn to this new way of living into which Jesus invites us, in out of which the entirety of creation was created in the first place.
So it's rather interesting that in a rather desperate moment in the early part of this century, the Windsor Report, so-called, which was attempting to attend to the crisis occasioned initially by Eugene Robinson's consecration as a bishop, as an openly gay man, attempted a theology of covenant to, as it were, glue the Anglican Communion back again together. And I'm not sure that it was sufficiently noted at the time, as I recall, that to appeal to a notion of covenant was a strikingly Presbyterian metaphor. Would you like to comment on that briefly?
Yes, I think that is true. There was in the literature at that time a good deal of talk about whether or not covenant is something that Anglicans can be governed by, or ought to be governed by, given the premium placed in our ecclesiology on the particular kinds of relational autonomies, those that doesn't mean free liberties, but relational autonomies that govern the relationship of the churches and the communion. So that there was a question there about that. In general, however, in my view, the reason that the covenant ultimately did not prevail is because the Anglican Communion itself, in many of its locales, rightly, in my view, saw that what was being offered in that covenant was a structural solution for a relational problem, that you can't legislate better relationships. And that was what the Windsor Report was advocating through the covenant idea. Much more, I think, helpful in this regard is a subsequent report, Community and Conflict in Hope, which was also out of the IATDC, that was a report on an ecclesiology that it asks us to understand that we are going to disagree, but we can lovingly disagree, and conflict can be had in a way that's profitable, so that we can all grow together in an important way. And also the Indaba process that was employed at the 2008 Lambeth Conference of All Anglican Bishops, based on a Zulu process of storytelling, where the encounter and dialogical meeting of stranger across a table, one-to-one, life-to-life, sharing with one another and understanding and beginning to trust one another is the way that we overcome the kinds of divisions that plague us, not these structural solutions.
That's very interesting, because we can see in these last years a sort of floundering around within the Anglican Communion for an agreed ecclesiology, and I don't think we have finished this process. A third feature of our contemporary context, which is agonizing in this country particularly, is that of the divisions caused by racism and the historic history of slavery and racism in this country. And many people, I think, attribute a lot of loss of membership of the Episcopal Church to this context. In this series, we're actually going to spend a whole session on this problem. It's going to be the next one. But I think it's very worth underlining that our current presiding bishop, Michael Curry, has responded to this with a strongly Johannine vision of ecclesiology to attack it or to heal it, you might say. And since we didn't discuss the Johannine aspects of ecclesiology in our first New Testament session, I think it's worth pausing here for a moment, because we recall that in John chapter 15, we not only have the wonderful metaphor of the vine and the branches that are united in Christ more deeply than can almost be expressed organically, but also the strong statement by Jesus that I am no longer calling you slaves, but friends. And so I think we should see our presiding bishop as opting for a Johannine vision. And in a minute, we're going to talk about some other Johannine visions that have dominated in the ecumenical scene. But I think it's important to stir this into our reflection today about where Episcopal ecclesiology is leading. Is there something you would like to add to that?
No, I think that the in terms of the Johannine emphasis there, what the presiding bishop is after is the unity that John is extolling, that the oneness of the church, and particularly of being one in Christ, that is that one in me, as Jesus puts it, right? You are brothers, and in sort of using that familial imagery for talking about what it means to be a follower of him. And that is a crucial element to any ecclesiological perspective, but it is an element, right, as opposed to the sum total of an ecclesiological vision, for a number of reasons that we could talk about now, or we could wait until we do take up that more ecumenical vision as well, depending upon how our conversation unfolds.
But just to note that what we discussed in the first session about the radicality of Paul's notion of the united body and its notion of adopted sonship has its parallel in John in this vision.
That's right. And I think the important thing for me there is where the Johannine version tends to emphasize the oneness and the organic image of the vine and branches that you brought up tends to flatten the kind of membership into a sort of sameness. Mm-hmm. The body image of Paul is a very differentiated image of what it means to be church. And so what you have is a notion of church as a place where there is unity and deep, deep, deep cohesion and relationality across difference. And that is, the for me, a very important I don't like to use functional language when talking about church because it sounds overly reductive, but it's an important function of church, is to serve as a place where people come together in their discipleship across difference, and not in spite of difference, but because difference in this image is a gift. Difference in this image is something that allows for the variegation of life to come into the ecclesial family and orbit in a way that enriches it for everyone involved.
Now, a final consideration about the novelty of the context we're confronting at the moment ecclesiologically, along with the dramatic loss of membership, the global perspective, the historic tragedy of American racism. A fourth one is this, the phenomena of the pandemic, what we are still going through, and the extraordinary way in which church has become airwave bound worldwide in a new way, not just as a global communion, but because we can choose to watch whatever services we like, wherever and whenever we like. And I think this is raising really fascinating new questions for ecclesiology, which are not yet resolved, frankly, and won't be for a while. And because you and I have found this so fascinating, we decided we would intercept here a little interview that I conducted earlier with Brother James Kester, who is the superior of the Society of St. John the Evangelist in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the oldest monastic male community of the Anglican Church. And during the pandemic, initially, as we shall hear, his brethren did not want to go online to send out their services to other people, but they changed their minds dramatically. And at the end of this, they have come to some really interesting new conclusions. So here we're going to snip in to what Brother James told me from his cell earlier this week. Welcome, James, and thank you so much for taking part in this conversation. Could I ask you first what your community's initial reaction to the idea of live streaming services, including the Eucharist, was during lockdown? Were you unambiguously positive about this or quite skeptical?
Well, thank you for inviting me into this conversation, Sarah. I have to admit, we've had this kind of conversation has been going on in the community for a number of years. And every time we've had it, it's been the response has been over my dead body. We simply were not interested in doing anything online, at least anything live online. We have been, for the last number of years, we've been doing pre-recorded Lenten programs, but we haven't been recording our worship for a monastic community dedicated to St. John the Evangelist, the author of the fourth gospel. The mystery of the incarnation is really important to us. And so we simply flatly refuse to consider doing something, at least worship online, because we didn't understand how it could be incarnational. And so when it was first suggested that we start to live stream or pre-record or video record our worship, there was a real fear that it would turn worship into performance. And so it actually took a lot of conversation to get us moving. The first thing that happened was we were asked by the diocese to pre-record Maundy Thursday, the Maundy Thursday liturgy. We then had another conversation when we got ready for our patronal festival for St. John's Day at the beginning of May. We decided that we would live stream evening prayer. It was those two initial steps that we discovered how hungry people were for worship online, how hungry people were for some kind of connection with us, even though it was through the lens of a camera, and how much we needed to do this as well. That our dedication is to St. John the Evangelist, and so evangelism, proclamation of the good news, is very much in our DNA, and we actually need to do that to be faithful to who we are as monastics. from St. John's Day, we began to live stream evening prayer. And we made the decision that if we were going to do this, we actually needed good quality cameras. And so we invested in good quality cameras. We got a live stream consultant in. They talked about where cameras could be positioned. And slowly but surely, we got used to the cameras. And we weren't aware of there being a change in worship becoming performance. And the reality is, worship is performance. Liturgy is performance. The drama of the liturgy is a performance art. And so recognizing that was also a significant movement for us. That yes, we are praying, but we're also performing something. The biggest struggle was, of course, live streaming the Eucharist. And what would that mean? And how would we do that? And so we actually spent a lot of time with a couple of theologians talking about what the sacrament, what a sacramental life in a digital age would look like. And is the Eucharist simply about eating and drinking the bread and wine? Or is the sacrament of the Eucharist much broader than that? And the result of the conversation is we recognize that sacramental theology is much broader than simply eating and drinking. It's also about hearing. It's about participating. It's about even observing. And so bit by bit, we move to where we are today.
Thank you very much for these reflections. I feel that adds a very important theological gloss to what otherwise had seemed originally to be just a temporary necessity.
Right.
Thank you so much for joining us, and many blessings to the community.
Thank you very much.
That raises some really interesting ongoing questions, which I think will help inform what we're now moving to discuss. On the one hand, if we are to believe Brother James, then there is a kind of incarnational principle that resists not joining together physically, and especially, of course, to receive the body and blood of Christ. On the other hand, there seems to be a kind of new intensification of the Anglican and Cranmerian tradition of the idea of the blessed company of all faithful people as a mystical unity that mysteriously can link together even when they are separated by time and space. So perhaps we can feed that into what we're now going to discuss, even though it's unfinished business for our church. So perhaps, Scott, now I can move into the second part of this interview, which is really about, if that's the context, what are our sources now as a church for rethinking contemporary Episcopal ecclesiology? And I want to ask you to say something about what one of your books is mainly about, which is the incredibly important ecumenical backcloth in ecclesiology, which forms, I think, the most important input that any church ecclesiology has to think about now if it's ecumenically interested. And this goes back, of course, to the Vatican II, to the great reform of the Roman Catholic Church and its change of metaphors about how to think about church, because this has affected us all. So perhaps you could come in now and tell us about that.
Thank you. So yes, Vatican II was a watershed moment in so many ways for the Western Church, and ecclesiology is no exception. How we conceptualize church changed dramatically as a result of the Vatican II documents. Lumen Gentium is an important constitution on the church that inverted for the first time the Roman Catholic understanding of what church actually is, the people of God notion that that document puts forward as a crucial way of imagining church begins not with the high echelons of a church hierarchy, but with the laity. for the first time in Catholic social teaching, that this is a signal moment. It can't be underestimated how incredibly crucial that was and how that carried through the Vatican reforms, some of which were rolled back under certain pontificates and so forth, not without controversy, but it was a watershed moment. And for us in the Episcopal Church, it was a direct influence on the development of the 1979 Book of Common Prayer and its baptismal ecclesiology. In other words, a recovery of the understanding that every baptized person is a minister in Christ's church. Every disciple is someone who is charged as an agent with carrying out the work of God and God's creation. And that is a hugely crucial ecclesiological imperative for us to keep in mind as we re-envision what church might look like going forward in a world that we can't really predict at the current time.
And of course, in this country, Cardinal Avery Dulles, after the Vatican Council, wrote an immensely influential textbook on models of the church, which I think have influenced all ecclesiologists since, in which, in the light of the Vatican Council, he spelled out a number of different models which he felt had to be complementary to one another in any future ecclesiology. These were institution, which of course we're all familiar with from older visions of the papacy, and indeed institutions in our own church, community, by which he was very much including this new idea of the people of God, which went back to strands in the New Testament. Yeah. Sacrament, the idea that the church is itself sacramental. This is a slightly sort of higher church vision, you might say. Mm-hmm. And then herald of the gospel, which I think was a very strong bow to the Reformed, Lutheran and Reformed churches, and the power of the word. Servant, the idea that what the church is here to do is to wash others' feet, again, in the spirit of Johannine thinking. And then interestingly, he later added in a further edition of the book, the idea of the church as a school of discipleship, which is again, Johannine, and seems to me to cohere very closely to what our current presiding bishop is looking for. The idea that we join a school of discipleship that is set on union with each other. So these models are very much in the mind, I think, of all ecclesiologists even now. But in your own book, you point out how one particular model of the church actually went on to dominate the ecumenical scene in a very major way, which you see as both very positive and rich, but also as having some demerits. So the floor is yours now again to explain what you.
So in my book, what I talk about is communion ecclesiology, which is all unquestionably the reigning model for the way that we think ecclesiologically at the ecumenical level. Mm-hmm. And this does stem in some ways directly from Vatican II, but also from the work of people like Jean-Marie Roger Thiers and of Jean Zizioulas, an Orthodox theologian of great renown, at the World Council of Churches, and how these currents of thinking about church as both a horizontal and a vertical set of communal relationships instantiate the Johannine imperative toward unity. And that's the overall and very laudable guide for the way we can think about church and ought to think about church going forward. In my view, one of the things that this misses, however, is the fact that the Johannine view of the unity of the church and indeed of all things ultimately is, it thinks of this often as a present reality in the Johannine literature, or at least as an available reality of which one could avail oneself, or groups and communities could avail themselves of, if they just evinced the proper will to do so. I'm not trying to ascribe a certain kind of creeping Pelagianism to them, but there is a sense that there is an extant reality of unity that exists if only we would opt into it. My view is that this is part of God's promise for eschatological fulfillment, that communion, the fullness and richness of communion, is the thing toward which we aim, because that is the thing that Jesus' resurrection seals as a divine promise to us, and that we must instantiate and practice toward in church. because we know the world is broken and not unified, and our church is broken and not unified. Our relations attest to this on a daily basis. And so to be overly confident in unity starts to cover over, I think, the very real deficiencies of sin and brokenness that surround us, indeed, in our churches every day. And so the church as a school of discipleship is meant to point us toward that unity and also out into the world, insert love and service to the world. It's a simultaneous vision of all of the various facets that Dulles was talking about and knew he had to bring together. It brings them all into a kind of tension that we need to maintain.
So you could say, I think, in a way, that the impetus of the ecumenical movement after the Second World War, which of course was thinking so viscerally about the division of the world in this terrible war and the Holocaust, so that the changes of attitude to the Jews and also in represented in Vatican II were very much a part of this quest for union. Yes. You could say that this led to an extremely well-intentioned desire for reunion of all people. Yes. To the cost of other elements in our ecclesiological thinking to some extent, and to the cost of the idea that there is a already, but also a not yet in our ecclesiological thinking. We saw how vital that element was in Jesus's own teaching of the kingdom. So I think the problem here has been that people in recent years have rather lost confidence in the ecumenical movement. Precisely because it doesn't seem to have been able to deliver that which it promised. But you're saying that this may be respondable to through the resuscitation of more dynamic, future-oriented dimensions of New Testament ecclesiology.
Indeed. I think that there's been a shift in large part in the ecumenical movement. Even within the movement itself, away from seeking the visible unity of the church, which had been its goal since Edinburgh in 1910, it had been its goal, toward the notion of bi and multilateral dialogues, where those relationships become very important and very salient, and in some instances will move toward full unity and full communion. And we have many examples of that. Anglicans have been at the forefront of that work from the very beginning. And so that is an imperative of ours that a wonderful legacy that we've been involved with. And at the same time, we also have an appreciation for simply being in ecclesial touch with our Christian brethren across the differences that we share as one Christian family, without needing to seek for full, or at least feeling the responsibility to always seek for full visible unity at that level, which may not be possible or even envisionable given some of the deep, deep divisions that exist, the overcoming of which would take a lot of groundwork, relational building, theological rapprochement, a whole centuries of work. When one thinks about how long it took for the Lutherans and the Roman Catholics to reach the point they reached in 1999 of talking simply about satisfaction and justification, that centuries can sometimes be required to do this kind of work. And so there's a time scale for the an already and a not yet here as well.
So there's another thing that I think needs to be thrown into the pot here, given what you've been saying, not just this ecumenical background, not that we should give up on the ecumenical thrust towards full shared communion, but that we have to place it in a context in which the already and not yet are present to us in our ecclesiological thinking. But the other thing I'm thinking of here is that we talked in the second video about the distinctive contribution of Anglican ecclesiology through the agonies of its own vicissitudes in the 16th and 17th centuries. And what you're saying now about the acknowledgement of difference and the negotiation of difference seems to me to be a specifically Anglican and Episcopal tradition, which unfortunately seems to have also become rather lost in the very profound and hostile differences that we're confronting internationally within the communion. There's a kind of learned history of how to stay at the table, if you like. Could you say something about that? And perhaps also something about classic texts in our Episcopal tradition that bespeak that.
Yes, I think that from the beginning of the Anglican, what would become the Anglican experiment during the English Reformations, it is important to keep in mind that while one can have a pragmatic or realpolitik view of what happened during the Elizabethan settlement, when the Queen famously said that she had no intention of making a window into men's souls, that does serve a practical purpose when one is the state, when the church is the state and the state is the church and citizenship and church membership are coextensive, that becomes a pretty important premium to maintain. However, also, there is a theological imperative here to say there is a way that we can worship God together with a certain kind of latitude of theological interpretation of what we are doing, that settlement opens up. That becomes really important for Anglican self-understanding as the centuries go by. And what I mean by this is, Anglicans, as theologians, tend to prescribe doctrinally very little at the sense of requiring certain tenets of propositional belief that one must hold in order to be properly Anglican. What I'm not saying is that there are no boundaries to Anglican theological imagination. That is not true at all. But what Anglicanism, the genius in my view of Anglican theology does is set up those boundaries so that there can be some free range for discernment, theological discernment within that realm. So that when we take seriously, as Anglicanism does, the importance of the scriptures above all, as the guardian of the faith and containing all things sufficient for our salvation, as the Articles would put it, Article 6. When we take the historic creeds and formularies as something that's incredibly urgent for us to maintain, when we understand the historic episcopate as something that is characteristic of our particular way of being church, the way our polity is set up, the way our political organization is set up, and when we think of the sacraments, particularly baptism and Eucharist, as the dominical sacraments or the sacraments that were instituted by Jesus Christ, that is as the sort of boundary for a theological imagining in an Anglican mode, then we're allowed a certain kind of latitude to interpret the tenets, say, of the creed in a variety of different ways that does not keep us in lockstep with one another theologically, but allows us to remain co-partners in worship together in the same ecclesial project. This is a gift that Anglicanism gives to the wider Christian witness, in my view. It actually, as you quite rightly pointed out, has built into it an imperative to stay together even across difference. And I want to go back to what I said before about the image of the body out of Paul, because of the difference and thinking of the difference as important. In my view, Anglican theology is a theology that seeks the wisdom necessary for theological discernment. Because our church is not a church that tells people what to think, and because we have a teaching office that does that, that's something we do not have. We need to equip the people of God, if we really believe that ecclesiology, with the ability to do that kind of deep theological work. And that means being able to be interpreters of our tradition and of our world, and to coordinate those two things together. And that's going to mean we're going to do it differently.
And this is often assumed to be just waffly thinking, especially by Roman Catholic critics, who of course have their own magisterium, but I think you and I probably agree that the extraordinary subtlety of how Richard Hooker, for instance, expressed the relationship of the primary authority of scripture to tradition, which is demanding on us, but with the application of a notion of reason to negotiate agreement through difference, is a very learned feature of the Anglican and Episcopal tradition. And that there aren't many modern documents that re-instantiate that, obviously, but the Chicago Lambeth Quadrilateral, so-called, of at the end of the 19th century, is important here, and you can read it at the end of the 1979 prayer book. Do you want to say a word about that?
Because I do.
Unfortunately, these days we don't have, most of us worship in services where we just have one sheet, so we don't have our prayer books in the pews anymore, but pick up a prayer book and you will find it. So tell us what's important about it.
I highly encourage it. And while you're back there reading the historical documents, take a look at the 39 Articles of Religion. That's also very important. But the thing that's important with the Chicago Lambeth Quadrilateral is, while that was originally meant to be precisely what we were talking about a moment ago, that is an ecumenical gesture toward reunion of the churches, it very quickly became a statement about Anglican identity across the Anglican communion. That is, the Anglican churches were understood to be those churches which, without crossing their fingers, were able to ascribe wholeheartedly to the primacy of Scripture in all of its fullness, to the dominical sacraments, as just mentioned, to the episcopate, locally instantiated according to its historical forms it has taken in those places under those conditions, and the historic creeds provides us with a wide range of ways of being church within that framework that allow us to be recognizably Anglican to one another without having to look, sound, or feel the same from place to place.
So just to sum up this interview, Scott, because I know you have very specific views about this, in the current crises in which we find ourselves, I think we both agree a loss of theological thinking about church is lethal. A loss of our historic sensibility about the distinctiveness of Anglicanism and Episcopal thinking about church is lethal. But we're facing new challenges. So out of the resources, particularly the scriptural resources that we've inherited as primary, what would you say we mainly need to focus on theologically in our thinking about the church today?
Theologically, in my view, the thing that we need to focus on for more than anything else is that the church is vocationally charged with being that community of disciples that is meant to anticipate the fullness of communion that God promises at the end of all things. That is what we are about. The church is born as witness to the resurrection of Christ. It's an eschatological event having to do with the inbreaking of the end of time into the time-space continuum. And what does that do to those who witness it and those who are changed by the attestation of it? And that is what our charge is. And what that means is we are living in two times. We live in our current moment, and we do so with an eye toward the future that is promised to this creation, which is the perfection of our relationships among ourselves and with God. And in order to instantiate that, we need to take certain risks, try certain things while remaining, as was just pointed out a moment ago about the status of tradition, while remaining deeply in conversation with the wisdom of those who have come before us in the faith, and not rejecting what their hard-earned insight afforded them, but capitalizing on that and bringing it forward in a new day in a way that we have discerned carefully and thoughtfully and, more above all, prayerfully, to be salutary for this instantiation of the work of God in this particular place and time. And that what that requires then is the retention of nerve. It's going to mean that we need to not be afraid. We need to not panic. We need to not fear the other as a threat. See, I think going back to the covenant conversation, that was also driven by fear and anxiety. So we need to not do those things. Instead, we need to operate out of our hopes. We believe in a God that raises life out of graves. And if that is true, then the changes that we're seeing in the Episcopal Church are not necessarily signs of death, but of change. And there is life on the, we may not be able to imagine it right now any more than the disciples could imagine Jesus coming to visit them on Easter Sunday. So we don't know what that church is going to look like, but we must live also out of our hope as people of faith that this body that we are constituted to be as disciples of Christ is not finished. And there's more to do. This is risky, vulnerable, and can be scary work, but we are not to lose our nerve. I think that's the important thing that we must maintain.
Thank you very much, Professor McDougall. And we will take up again this theme of not losing one's nerve, otherwise known as the theological virtue of hope, which I think we're very much in need of as we go forward to the next and last major video in this series. Thank you again.
Thank you.